Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, and I'm very excited for today's show. Later in the show, we have Tom Valenti coming on. He's one of our favorite chefs from Manhattan. He's done a lot of great stuff for a long, long time.
For a long time. One of those guys who's been around for forever at the top of his game. But I have to talk, before Tom comes on the show, I have to talk a little while about this past weekend. We were celebrating with my father-in-law, and he made a special request, a special restaurant request. He requested that we take him to Rutt's Hut because he had never been.
Can you call that a restaurant?
You know, there is seating, large seating, as a matter of fact. There's probably 100 seats. I never knew.
I never knew that. That must be new.
No. It's been there forever and ever and ever. We need to tell everybody what Rutt's Hut is exactly.
Still in the audience. It's...
If you've never been to Rutt's Hut, it's up in North Jersey. It's actually, I grew up in Nutley, so it was less than 3 or 4 minutes from my house.
Wayne, I believe. On Route 46.
It's on Route 46. It's not in Wayne. I think
Totua?
It's in Clifton or Passaic. But
whatever.
Either way. Doesn't matter. But it's right on Route 21,
has
just outside of
Nutley. Has been referenced in The Sopranos.
And has been referenced everywhere. It's just one of those legendary hot dog places. You know, my rule, if the hamburgers cost less than the hot dogs, don't buy a hamburger.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And that's the truth. The hamburgers are cheaper than the hot dogs here. So we go into Rutt's Hut because, you know, and we bring my kids and my brother-in-law's kids are all there and my father-in-law, mother-in-law, there's 12 or 13 of us. And we go to Rutt's Hut. This is the place that he's decided that he wants to celebrate in.
I love the idea.
It's a great idea.
I love it.
But realize that Rutt's Hut has kind of two entrances. One is just kind of a counter entrance that, you know, Francis and I is, I've been going there for 20 years. I've never been into the door that leads into the restaurant.
Yeah, I didn't know there was one.
Okay. But from what I understood, it was kind of like a bar that older people went to and would hang out and have a couple of beers and a ripper and a howdy.
You got to explain that.
There are different gradations of hot dogs at Rutt's Hut. One is a medium, and that's kind of like your traditional hot dog, and they're deep-fried hot dogs. The next is a ripper that cooks so much that the skin splits open.
And it's ripped.
And it's ripped, and so it kind of rips open.
My favorite thing about Rutt's Hut is they still use the old-fashioned ordering, like from the 1950s, like you order something, and then they give it in short-order cook lingo and the microphone. So if you order two... hot dogs done that way and an orange soda, the girl behind the counter says, two rippers and a howdy.
So a lot of people know that, who listen to the show anyway, that my mother-in-law likes to cook things for a really long time.
Yeah.
Last time they were at my house, we cooked them a chicken. We left. She put the chicken back in the oven for an hour and a half. Then ate it and said, oh, it's perfect.
Mm.
And then we threw the chicken out, the leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
But Rutt's has a cremator, okay? It's a hot dog that's just blackened. I mean, it's just been in the frying oil for so long.
Why would one eat such a thing?
Jennifer's mom ordered one.
And did she like it?
She did not. It was actually overdone even for her. But my favorite Rutt's Hut moment. Okay. In the dining room now, this is kind of worn down, old, beat up kind of a room. But my favorite moment in this room, as I walk in, it's got a special board.
Uh-huh.
And on the special board is grilled duck.
No way.
I swear to you. So I turn to the woman and I go, do a lot of people order the duck? And she looks at me and she goes, you'd be surprised.
I would have ordered the duck just to check it out.
To which I think to myself, of course, yeah, I would be. But my favorite line of the entire day, is it good? Her response, it comes out on fire.
Did you order it?
I did not. I'm sorry. I went and had a couple of rippers, and I'll be honest with you, the experience in the dining room, just simply not as good as the experience at the counter.
Well, the interesting thing about Rutz Hut, and I know that you and I have talked about this because...
Great onion rings, too, by the way. I got to tell you, just the best onion rings.
But I'm originally from North Jersey as well, and literally, this is a dump on the highway. It's on Route 46, and...
Route 21.
Is it 21?
It's on 21, I promise.
It was one of those North Jersey highways. But I remember that, you know... The dining room, not only did you not eat in the dining room, no matter the weather, you eat at Rutz Hut in the parking lot.
Right. You get your hot dogs, and you walk out and you eat in the parking lot.
I mean, I've sat on the curb out there.
I will tell you that there were people eating in the parking lot when we pulled up. There's like five people eating in the parking lot. That's what they were doing.
Well, so I recommend Rutz Hut.
Wow. I got to tell you, it is a classic, legendary place that everybody needs to go to at least once.
And if you're from New Jersey and you want to claim to be from New Jersey, that's a piece of Jerseyana.
It is a piece of Jerseyana, no doubt about it.
Fried hot dogs. It comes out
on fire.
But you don't have to order the duck to get the Jerseyana. I don't believe that a lot of people order the duck.
Yeah, I don't believe her either. I don't think I'd be surprised.
Hey, have you seen that there is now a larger demand for something that we've been looking for and buying for a long time? It seems as though Mexican Coke is being offered as a specialty. Even some Costcos in the Southwest are getting specifically Mexican Coke. It's funny because Mark and I, you know, we have a large Mexican population in New Brunswick. We have a number of Mexican restaurants, and they serve Mexican Coke.
Some of them, not all of them.
Some of them serve Mexican Coke, and it says... Hecho en Mexico on the bottle, and it's in Spanish, and it's in a glass bottle. But the really big difference is something we talk about all the time. Mexican Coke is made with cane sugar to sweeten it, and American Coke is made with high fructose corn syrup.
And I know they've done these studies. This one, some people like American Coke better, some people like Mexican Coke better. To me, there is no question about it. Mexican Coke tastes better.
Well, the
Coke made with cane sugar is so different and so much more thirst-quenching.
Absolutely. In the early 80s, they phased out of using sugar in American Coke. And when I'm in Europe, I get Coke all the time. And in Europe, they use sugar as well. There is unquestionably an aftertaste with high fructose corn syrup. And another thing about high fructose corn syrup is you ever, like, you finish a Coke and then you want more, you're like, that comes from the high fructose corn syrup, whereas the sugar is very clean. But they didn't, they asked a Coca-Cola spokesman, is there really any difference in taste? And he says no. He's a liar. He's a complete liar, liar, liar. His pants are actually on fire.
Much like the duck at Rutz Hut. We are not advocating that you should go out and start drinking Coke by the liter. But
if you're going to drink
but
Coke,
if you're gonna drink Coke
Mexican,
have it with the sugar.
Mexican
okay?
Coke is the way to go.
Let's face it.
And if you're around Central Jersey, you can find a lot of Mexican restaurants. But in real Mexican restaurants, they're in glass bottles, and they say Hecho en Mexico. And you can ask your retailer to get it in now because they're importing Mexican Coke in the United States, and we think that's a great thing. It shows that we have really good taste, and it shows us saying, listen, you can't just foist your garbage on us, big corporate America. We want the real stuff. And, you know, a lot of people...
We want the real thing.
...are trying to avoid high fructose corn syrup, and this is a way to do it and do it in more moderation. Hey, listen, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Tom Valenti, one of our favorite chefs from New York, back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Tom Valenti. Tom is one of the most important chefs in New York. He is an author as well as a chef. He's the owner of the critically acclaimed West on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Chef Tom Valenti, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tom, I don't know, we've never met, really, but I have to say I've been eating your food for a long, long time. Before we opened our first restaurant, my favorite restaurant in New York that I used to go to all the time was Allison on Dominic, where you cooked many years ago. When was that? What were you cooking at Allison on Dominic?
You know, that was just above the tunnel entrance on Dominic Street. We opened in April of 1989. Very well-received little place, very romantic. Tucked out of the way. I think it unfortunately met its demise not long after September 11th, 2001, because people simply weren't you know, traveling downtown.
Sure.
Well, you also have to realize for us Jersey guys, it was really easy to get into.
Exactly.
To get to Allison on Dominic. You made it very easy for us.
Yeah, you didn't really get stuck in traffic on the way in or
out. Yeah, I know, right? Perfect.
Well, you know, I think people, I don't know if all of our listeners are familiar with your career, but I think that you were at a critical juncture in the role of the chef in our society and the role of chef in New York. You were sous chef for Alfred Portale at Gotham Bar and Grill, and then you went on to do your own thing, and I think it was almost before the first celebrity chefs, or maybe you were the first generation of celebrity chefs as we know them today. You think that the role of the chef has changed since you've been cooking?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, my class, the class being Charlie Palmer, David Burke, and Rick Moon, and Tom Colicchio, I think we're all kind of the first wave of French-trained American chefs, and that many of us did make the trek across the big pond to study with some great French chefs. Yeah, I think that has... you know, as we've grown up and out, no pun intended, you know, we've trained a lot of guys who have gone off to do very well as well.
You trained with Guy Savoie, who's a really important French chef who now has a venture in the United States. But that was a very classical French education. It was unusual for an American to go and train with somebody as prestigious as Guy Savoie in France. How did that come about, and how did that affect the way you cook?
Well, a little-known fact is that Guy Savoie did, in fact, come to America almost 25 years ago, and that he had targeted Greenwich, Connecticut as his first American effort. And I just, you know, it was a very lucky chain of events that led me to that restaurant. And I had been trained in pastry initially, so I went to work for Guy Savoie when he opened on Lewis Street in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is now a great restaurant called Restaurant Jean-Louis. And Jean-Louis Jarin, who has run that restaurant for many years, was actually Guy Savoie's chef de cuisine. So that's definitely a place worth checking out. But I actually started working for them in Greenwich, and when the pastry chef was scheduled to go on vacation in Paris, I went over to fill in, and I stayed.
It's my understanding you didn't have a lot of French back then. Did you speak French when you left?
I didn't speak any French.
See, Tom, I did it very differently than you did it. I went and spent a summer in college in France, but I didn't go there to cook. I went there to eat.
Now, there's a smart move. Now you're talking. Well, you know, I was there, and at the time in my early 20s, I was one of the fortunate few Americans to actually be paid. And I was getting $500 a month. My rent was $360 a month, obviously not translating into French francs, but, you know, consequently, my eating budget was nil. So you made a right move there.
What now?
Yeah, I was in college. I didn't have a huge eating budget, though, I got to tell you, Tom.
Some is better than none.
You're right.
But the classic, my understanding of what a classic French kitchen on that level was like as far as the discipline and the hard work and the complexity of it. How did you manage without the language, and how did they receive you over there as an American?
Well, I think that, you know, at first they resisted me, but, you know, when I did go into Phil for pastry, I was kind of put into the basement, and it was a basic production where language wasn't really an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And when the young French cooks would come downstairs after their shift, they started to take a shine to me because I gave them pastry and trade. So slowly a piece of cake would mean them speaking English and eventually teaching me French.
You know, it all comes down to giving somebody a cookie, doesn't it?
It's all about coercion.
It's like being at... Hey,
that was how my mom got me to behave when I was a little kid, too.
It works.
We're gonna take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk more with Tom Valenti, one of the best chefs in New York. His restaurant is West. He has several books out and one coming out, which we'll talk about in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagata and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today we're talking with one of our favorite New York chefs, Tom Valenti of Restaurant West.
You know, Chef, you started basically as an apprentice. That's basically how you started.
Yeah, right out of high school.
And we have, you know, a lot of people going to school now. We've had a couple of chefs come on our show and talk about how they don't really like the trend in
culinary schools.
What's your preferred way of someone learning the skills of being a chef? Is it better to be an apprentice, or is it better to go to school and then become a...
Well, you know, I think that both disciplines offer wonderful learning opportunity. You know, I never had a culinary education, so I have nothing to compare it to. But what I do know is that with the gaining popularity of becoming a chef, I think there was a period of time a couple of years ago where I saw what I thought were the schools trying to recover from an over demand, and I think they've balanced out. And I think that many of them offer, you know, a great curriculum. French Culinary Institute here in New York is one very good example. You know, but being a chef is not just about cooking, and I think that eventually, when you do run your own restaurant, I think that a good basic business undergraduate degree is a good thing too.
You know, it's funny. I have a nephew who's he's just a teenager now. He's 13, and he really wants to enter the restaurant business. And I told him that you know, I want him to have a basic understanding of business if he wants to do that. I think one of the things that I find most disturbing about young people applying for jobs coming out of culinary school today is, you know, someone coming out of school looking for an entry-level job in a kitchen, or maybe a second up from the entry-level job in the kitchen, and they've got $75,000 worth of debt.
That's right.
And, you know, you don't have a law degree, you have a culinary degree.
Right, and right. You're looking at a $22,000 job with your $75,000 worth of debt.
Are you seeing that same sort of phenomenon happening in New York, in your places, in your field?
Absolutely, and I think that it can be damaging in some ways, only because, you know, the logistics of cooking are really understanding, and, you know, it's much like, you know, working out, lifting weights. You don't really get the results until you feel the burn. I think that there's a certain discipline that has to exist in cooking, where you have to do something over and over and over again until you really get it, so that in 10 or 15 years down the road, you're trying to teach someone something in your kitchen. You have to be able to do it, you know, essentially better than they do. And consequently, I think that when you have that type of debt hanging over your head, you want to accelerate a little quicker.
You need to.
And get up the ladder a little quicker and make a little more money so you can pay the debt down. And it's kind of a disservice to the craft.
Yeah, I agree, and I want to talk more about you with your craft and the particular kind of food that you do, because I think it's different than anybody else cooking right now in Manhattan. We'll be back after the news with Tom Valenti of Restaurant West in New York City in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Yeah. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cathal Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with Tom Valenti. He's one of our favorite chefs and I think one of the most important chefs in New York cooking today. His restaurant is West. And Tom, we were talking earlier about sort of your class of people, like the Colicchio class of people, the David Burke class of chefs that came in, were classically French trained and then sort of translated that cuisine for an American audience. You staked out a unique ground, though, I think. And early on, you were famous for your lamb shanks. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, Tom Valenti's lamb shanks are amazing. And they are, and they were. And I remember reading an article where you were interviewed, oh, God, in the late 80s. And they had become such a phenomenon that people were eating these lamb shanks, which are done very slowly and braised very slowly over time. It's a big hunk of meat. And you're like, yeah, I started this as a winter special. Now people are eating them in July and August. I don't get it, but I can't take them off the menu.
I also have to blame you, by the way. When I first opened the restaurant, lamb shanks were like $1.25 a pound.
I know.
Now they're like $12 a pound.
So, but that's indicative of something else that I see with a lot of your cooking. It's not so, as bad now, but for a long time it was everything was an extreme cooking method, high heat, fast, a lot of altitude, a lot of spice, a lot of you know, cooking everything in a very high flame. And Tom Valenti's food, some of your best food, is stuff that's done in advance, is like your gravlax or your lamb shanks, which are cooked for a long time, right, very slowly. Is your food slower than most people's, and why?
Well, I think that it came together for a number of reasons. I think that, you know, for example, at Allison on Dominick Street, we had a very, very small kitchen, so consequently I was forced to look at some advanced preparation techniques. You know, and I think secondly, we were coming off a trend in the late 80s where everything was, in fact, high heat, grilled quick, you know, laid over a salad of mesclun greens with, you know, sun-dried tomato and goat cheese. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think that I was looking for something a little bit different. And I think the biggest influence had to do with not so much my French training, but my Italian heritage. I mean, I grew up in a for all intents and purposes, Italian-speaking household, and there wasn't a lot of money there. And I think that what I responded to as a kid had a lot to do with slow-cooked, on-the-bone stuff.
So Tom, I guess the question is, I mean, you've opened so many different stylistic kinds of places, and so frequently a restaurant is the chef's expression of who he is. Mm-hmm. You know, with all those different kinds of places you've opened, who are you?
Good question. Well, I think that I try to straddle the line between restaurant as theater, which it certainly has to be to some extent, but I think it also has to do kind of with a, you know, I think that I use the term taste memory to relate back to where people find their comfort zone as it relates to food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that, you know, it really is a product of a lot of classic French training with an Italian, a big round Italian grandma.
You know, one of the things that I think is also a signature of your food, and I've had the great good fortune to eat your food in a number of your different restaurants, is there are two other things that have been said about your food, besides it being, you know, a lot of slow-cooked, prepped in advance, you know, big round flavors that come from that. You always have generous portions. You're known for an abundance on the plate, mm-hmm, compared to many restaurants. And I heard a lot of people talk about your cooking as a very masculine style of cooking. Do you think those two adjectives are accurate? And what is a masculine style of cooking?
Well, you know, I think that flavor is obviously a big component of cooking. And if big flavor translates as masculine, so be it. But I don't think that the style across the board would suggest that type of, you know, hunk of meat that tips Fred Flintstone's car.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are there are a lot of subtle nuances, or at least as we try to achieve them. But, you know, and there is light cooking as well. I mean, we do work with a lot of fish and light game and poultry and things like that. But, again, I really think that there is a, you know, eating is, and food and consumption is a real base need. And I think that if you feel satisfied at a place, you don't feel like you've been beat up too bad, you go back.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask about something we talk about quite often on this show and people usually feel very strongly about. Something that seems almost the other side of the spectrum from your food is people who are cooking sort of on the cutting edge, avant-garde cuisine, people using liquid nitrogen and
molecular gastronomy.
What is your feeling on that? I would think that you would kind of like, I don't know, beat that guy up.
Judging by the chuckle, I'm thinking that.
Well, you know, I'm a rock and roll guy in the height of disco, I think. I don't, you know, I cook to satisfy a craving, not an intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And having said that, I think that there are some dynamically talented guys out there doing this stuff. And from my perspective, I think that it's positive because it evokes conversation, you know, within the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, you know, it made me kind of look back on where the soul satisfaction came by way of my upbringing or my training. So I find myself delving even deeper into the traditional stuff. I don't seek out the molecular gastronomy. I think, again, like, I think that it's fascinating and could probably be tasty in many instances. I just don't go there.
Tom, remember that rock and roll long-outlived disco.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think that what's interesting about these guys on the very cutting edge is it's interesting to read about, and I think that I look at some of how they sort of break things apart and reconfigure them, and I sort of... It spurs in me maybe sometimes a different understanding about how these traditional processes work to combine flavors, and it helps me to maybe understand traditional cooking more.
Exactly. I mean, a deconstructed cassoulet.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, yeah, I don't get it.
You know, but again, if you're separating it out and looking at the components and seeing what makes the thing work, you know, it's a good exercise for a lot of us professionals as it relates to what are they doing, why are they doing it, what makes this better than the original.
I think you used the right word there. It's an exercise, and exercise and going out to dinner for me don't marry.
Well, I think that also, you know, one is traditional cooking is soulful and satisfies the soul, and you sit down and think, wow, that's going to be a great meal. Whereas, like you said, this other stuff that's intellectual, and you think, you're eating your food thinking, you know, how did he fry mayonnaise? You know,
mm-hmm.
But what always comes to my mind is, but why did he fry mayonnaise? You know,
I could understand it because he was looking for texture, contrast on the plate. He was serving it, I believe, with tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, listen, I think that he, when we're talking about Wiley Dufresne, is brilliant.
Well, he is.
No question about it.
And I think that he is one of the rare instances that actually capture the satisfaction level,
mm-hmm.
along with the intellect. I have a great admiration for him.
Yeah, I think the thing about this, like, super highfalutin avant-garde cuisine is the guys who really master it in Chicago and Washington and Spain and
mm-hmm.
in New York. You know, it's really cool to go and do that, for me, maybe twice a year.
Right.
But the guys who kind of sort of just miss, the guys who are a little bit of a knockoff.
Yeah, you don't want to miss this by even a little bit.
It's a train wreck.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I think that if you miss on a lamb shank a little bit, it's still a good lamb shank.
Right. And I'm really, you know, I'm really a beautiful salad, piece of roast chicken, and a perfect piece of cheese kind of guy.
You're making me hungry, Tom.
You know, that's what gets me going.
Yeah, I'm with
Tom,
you.
I don't get to eat lunch for 16 minutes. Take it easy, all right?
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Tom Valenti, owner of West Restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where you should go if you haven't been. If you want to know how to get there, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll give you all the information. Back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're talking with Tom Valenti, chef, owner of West Restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. The Upper West Side of Manhattan, that was once known as a restaurant wasteland, Tom, and you sort of have colonized it. It's now called, they're going to change the name of it to Tom Valentiville, the neighborhood. Why the Upper West Side, and how did that come about?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, what you had mentioned Butterfield 81 earlier, that I was cooking on the Upper East Side, and I noticed that there were daily a number of West Side phone exchanges in the reservation book. And one thing led to another, and I ended up on 84th Street and Broadway.
And, there weren't a lot of restaurants there at the time.
No, but, you know, I think that what had changed on the Upper West Side was the demographic. You know, a lot of what I think drove the market up there was the residential real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, younger couples with families were moving in because the apartments were large, and at the time, believe it or not, I think it was a slightly softer residential real estate market. You know, we're talking 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, all of that has changed on the island of Manhattan at this point.
Yeah, there's no place to really find that cheap place. I had a rent-controlled apartment on 2nd Avenue in St. Mark's Place that I gave up. I'm the worst real estate guy ever. $500 a month.
That was the worst move
you ever
made.
You get a garage for $500.
Right, exactly. Hardwood
floors. I can't get a parking place for $500 a month. What are you talking about?
I had hardwood floors and a closet and windows in every room. Terrible. Anyway, but about your restaurant, West, you know, the thing about it, and I've dined there many times. I've actually had a friend who I mentioned to you on the break had worked for you for a while and thought well of the place, and that's what sort of brought me up there.
Right.
But it really does feel very homey and warm for Manhattan. I mean, are you looking to sort of replace someone's living room?
You know, that was kind of the idea. I mean, I think that, you know, we had to recognize that, you know, wanted to do a restaurant of enough quality that it would be considered a destination. But there were just such a huge population residentially surrounding that, you know, we wanted something where we could you know, do great food and great service, but, you know, let's just strip it down, and it's just, at the end of the day, it's just food. So we really wanted a place that is comfortable and welcoming.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think makes it comfortable and welcoming? What makes it feel like a living room? Because I've been to the bar a number of times, and I've dined in your restaurant a couple times there, and it feels really homey.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that staff conveys a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have a way of doing things, and it's decidedly professional, but, you know, it's got to be welcoming. It's got to be friendly. I think that hospitality is the word that not everybody remembers in the industry.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
We use that word a lot. Anyway, but, I mean, I don't want to say that your place isn't a tourist attraction, because obviously you have a lot of people outside of New York City coming, but that whole local feel of West, how do you achieve the local feel versus becoming one of the tourist attractions?
Is it possible to be a neighborhood restaurant in Manhattan these days?
I think so. I think that, you know, listen, if you set about building a business in Manhattan, restaurants particularly, you hope that what you're creating is accepted. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it was decidedly targeted to be a place that the neighborhood could feel comfortable popping into, because it, you know, for us being Upper West Side environs, it was, okay, you gotta get the babysitter, you gotta walk the dog, you gotta take a shower, you gotta change, you gotta put on some nice clothes, you gotta go to dinner. Ugh, who needs mm-hmm. the hassle? Mm-hmm. I wanna just jump out, grab something, and go. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I think that we achieved that, but it has, again, a lot to do with the staff and their tone. But it's also, I think, to some extent, defined by its users, the customer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you kind of set up a template or a palette and let them kind of use it as they see fit, you know, we've done our job.
All right. Well, we are coming to the end of the hour, but I want to ask you, I understand you have a new book coming out.
Yeah, this will be my third book. It'll be out probably in fall of 2008, and I'm doing, unlike the first two chef-oriented books, I'm doing Diabetes Cookbook.
Uh-huh. And so this is for diabetics to be able to cook robust and flavorful food.
Exactly.
You know, that's really interesting, because my mom's diabetic, and we talk all the time about real food, and I think that it's funny. My friends who are diabetic get educated real quickly about food and what affects them and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But there's so much that you can do if you have a good palate of flavors, if you can exercise a good palate of flavors, that can make food really great, even though you have, you know, that kind of a constraint.
Not to mention in the world today, I mean, everybody knows someone who's diabetic.
Exactly.
One of my closest friends is diabetic. They're coming over the house all the time. You know, you make them a big bowl of pasta and you know.
That's right.
And drive them right to the hospital.
And ruin their day.
Yeah, you know, it has been a challenge in writing the book. I think that we're succeeding well because we're recognizing, you know, pure, beautiful flavor. I mean, you know, bear in mind that white starch is carbohydrates and simple, you know, simple complex sugars are the devil in this case. But salt is also a big problem because diabetes and heart disease kind of go hand in hand. So, you know, take salt away from a chef, and you'll see him weeping uncontrollably. You know, so
same thing happens
really
to me, Tom.
My pardon?
Same thing happens to me. If you take it away from me, I weep uncontrollably.
You see, but the simple fact is that there has to be a control of sodium as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's challenging, but I think that we're coming out with some tasty stuff.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you for taking the hour to be with us in the Restaurant Guys. It's been a great conversation. You're swell.
Oh, we could talk all day, couldn't we?
We
yes,
could.
Indeed.
We could. But we're going to, if you guys want to learn more about Tom Valenti, the best way to do it is by eating his food. You can find out how to do that on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We were just talking with Tom Valenti, whose current restaurant is West. He has two great cookbooks out. He's coming out with a cookbook for diabetics, but he has two other great cookbooks out that are, you know, hearty recipes from Tom Valenti, and they're terrific. We'll put those up on our website as well. But his restaurant that I was talking to him about, that where he was a partner, which was called Allison on Dominic, was on Dominic Street, this abandoned street. Like, there was the warehouses and this cute little restaurant,
yeah.
White restaurant with pine trees out front. We used to go there all the time, and I remember from the moment you walked in, Allison on Dominic taught me a lot about atmosphere
mm-hmm.
and about how to evoke emotions by walking in the door, because it wasn't expensive, it wasn't grand. They had a flowing white something like curtain on the ceiling. The lights were indirect and soft. And here's what Allison on Dominic was the last restaurant to do that I recall. Long taper candles on the table. And this used to be de rigueur in
yeah.
all fine restaurants.
Yeah.
And they would
You made me put long taper candles on the tables at Stage Left
yeah,
when we first opened.
They weren't taper candles, they were formal candles, and we had a follower, because the long taper candles, it was just and you'd look at the whole dining room and there were a bunch of them unlit, but they were so elegant. They were long, they were like the 12-inch candles.
Mm-hmm.
And the maitre d' would walk over, light your candle on your table, and then come and get you and bring you to the table and sit you down. It was so elegant in the soft light of the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the dining room filled up, there were all these points of light. And the candles lasted about 2.5 hours. candle's gone, time to go home.
Sorry, you cannot have dessert. Your candle is gone.
But I remember, the other thing I remember is that was a really decadent thing to do because mm-hmm. we worked in a restaurant that had long taper candles, and they stopped. And mm-hmm. we never put long taper candles without the followers. We had the followers in the beginning. First of all, we spent $40,000 a year on candles.
Yep.
And secondly, we spent $20,000 a year getting wax out of stuff.
Oh, yeah. The wax onto everything. And the linen company hated us.
And occasionally, wax out of the diner's jacket or coat or, mm-hmm. or pants, which is, I think, the real reason why
sure.
every... I don't know of a single restaurant that does that anymore. It used to be every restaurant. But it was so elegant and so wonderful.
It's really pretty when you look at a restaurant and it's all... You really see the large burning flame. It's not... And we're not just talking about a candlelit restaurant where you have shades and things like that.
Or like a little tea light
A tea light, right, exactly. But the large burning flame of a candle all around the room.
So rich.
You talk about candles and being linked to romanticism. I mean, you go into a restaurant like that, and you can just feel it.
Yeah, it's true. But then you can feel they're going out of business, too, because they're paying for all those cleaning bills. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Sharp.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.